Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And that debt is fraud. And it's now or never, folks. And, you know, I keep on getting, and actually, let me just do the real quick obligatories. And it's a proud point that I can actually say this because we've got somebody that's being a champion for the Constitution. And I don't mean pride in going to my head. It's great to see other people stepping up, such as Jerry Wistrand out of Missouri, running his campaign for the Secretary of State. The auditor for the state. It's a statewide campaign. So all that being said, it's all about Constitution compliance. And I actually have an unforeseen, because it just dawned on me, that I kind of wanted to discuss this. So to be completely clear, folks, Sean has no inkling that I'm bringing this up. And it's not a gotcha or anything, Sean. So welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
So being somebody that's, I'm going to say, has a very broad reading and understanding, you're a scripture reader. And I'm proposing, you've never told me before that you've read the Bible from cover to cover, you know, multiple times, but there's no doubt that you love the word. And in the last days, we're told that, you know, there's going to be wars, rumors of wars, paraphrasing, you know, the signs of the last days, that there will be prophets and false prophets. Actually, to be more leery of false prophets. Is that an incorrect paraphrasing of what we would expect to see in the last days?
Oh, that's correct, sir. Not be deceived.
Deceived, I mean. So, what does that mean to you? When you look today, do you see a lot of false prophets? And if so, how? What are the false prophets that you see?
Oh, yeah, they're all over the place. You have from the New Age people to the whole gender issue, to the people that are talking about we should just allow anybody who wants to come into our country, you know, that would be the Christian thing to do. And none of it's ever biblically founded. It's all this feel good, New Agey, everybody, you know, we can all praise God in our own way. And it, you know, it's all good. And that suicidal empathy kind of Christianity.
So let me ask you this, because I think that this is where people have a disconnect because they don't read the scriptures. And I could be totally wrong, but they just don't read the scriptures with the Spirit. And when we look at the false prophets, these false prophets are, people are reading those as orthodox prophets. And a prophet, and in context to what John is speaking about in the scriptures there, is somebody that is predicting the future, somebody that is saying, the Christ has come and he's here. I mean, I think that's kind of a part of those scriptures is, you know, he is here, he is there, he has come, and those types of things. And say, you know, and as a matter of fact, I think the scriptures say, believe them not. As I look at what a person that's out there telling you what's happening, what isn't happening, and what we believe is a redeemer, I think that we have gotten to a point where people have lost sight of this very strict, you know, Godhead, this very strict, you know, reason why we're here, that we have become so ideologically wired that our politics has become our ideology of our faith and our spirit, where we get caught up and get all excited when we see somebody that is going to deliver us. Now, I'm saying this because I feel like there's many a times when I get information from people that, oh, you got to listen to this guy. This guy is really telling it like it is. And I think that people are kind of searching for somebody that's going to tell us what to do. And I believe that that is a huge misnomer. And I mean that in stating that we all have agency. We all have to make decisions for ourselves. And it's not about being convinced that this is some anointed one. As a matter of fact, as I read the scripture, you tell me if I'm wrong. In the last days, God has no intention in saving a country. His job is to save the world, you know, those spirits that have been true, and are those people here, I should say, that have been true, that it is about salvation of mankind, not the salvation of a country, a culture, or anything like that. Now, there is this, I think, a kind of a misunderstanding of the Jews and their role, because I look at it this way. I believe that it was foretold that they were his chosen one to, when you think about it, chosen to what? What have they done so far that makes them stand out that they've been chosen? Well, the one thing that they have consistently done, and they've done a great job at, is denying him. And apparently, to me, I just see that the Jews has been one very particular culture, this one group that were so hard-hearted, so stiff-necked, so, what's the best way, locked in a paradigm, incapable of being objective, that they denied him. They've sought every which way they can to this day to deny he's come. And I think that they were chosen to do that. That it will come to a point where they have to be humbled to their utter destruction, to where they finally bend their knees and bow their heads. Am I misinterpreting, or am I going down the wrong path?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's a very complex issue when you start getting into it. I mean, I think the whole moniker of chosen people, the reason that they were chosen was to bring forth the Messiah, to bring salvation to all the nations. And that was the people that he used to manifest that.
But how profound is this? That the one culture, the one group of people, other than those who have chosen to go in league with Satan, the one culture and the one group of people that refused to accept at the very end, at their utter destruction, they come to the epiphany, how wrong they were, and they bend their knee and they bow.
I think there's other religions are going to be caught in the same thing. I think the focus is just on Israel because they were chosen by him to bring forth the Messiah and to enact his will.
Yeah, because, isn't it scripture that all will bend their knee and all will bow and all will confess he is the Christ? All will.
All.
And I think that's right. And so to me, the significance is the one culture that he was born into. Christ was born into the tribe of Judah. And so that one culture that has denied him their entire existence since he's come. That right there, to me, is the breaking of, you know, this denial. That if you get those hard-hearted, you know, I mean, they're the exemplar of denying and everything else, because they walked and talked with him from the beginning of his life here on earth, you know, from his ministry. And so, to me, I just think that, you know, that sends the message to the world. If they had to do it, then we all have to do it. If, you know, those who were born in ignorance, those who really didn't understand. I mean, there's lots of people that I've seen that, you know, they're faithful attenders to a church, and, you know, they just go because they have clung to the apron strings of their mother, or, you know, their coattails of their father, and they've lived kind of based on their convictions, and they've been in the right place, and they've just never been challenged. So they're still there, but they just don't know. They don't have, they've never challenged the doctrine to see its, you know, its truthfulness and those types of things. So anyway, so I didn't want to go down this bent, but my point was this, because we were talking about false prophets. I today get an incredible amount, and I'm sure everybody does, and most people have learned not to, just don't send me videos. Don't send me videos of others and so forth. And these predictions, I mean, shoot, it was going crazy in Trump's first administration, because everybody was sending me Q reports and Q predictions and so forth. And right there, I perceived that as people looking at him as a false prophet. To me, that was a sign that false prophets have, you know, or we have been consumed to elevate people, to making them prophets in our eyes and minds, especially the way we talk to other people. Listen to what this guy is saying.
I think your analogy has a direct link to between the Jews and current day Americans. Look at what our founders gave us.
Yes.
And instead of them following the foundational principles and acting on their freedom and their liberty to be self-governing, they look for a savior. It's the same thing.
You know, I wish
they're always looking for something else, because they don't want to follow the law. They want to make up their own way of doing it. So just like when the Israelites wanted a king.
Yep, just like a lawyer wants
to fight for a king, crying for a king so they could be like everybody else when God told them they were supposed to be set apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like a lawyer when they want to try to find a new way to bend the law. Yes, so I wish I had this little teeny triangle to go ding, because you hit the nail on the head. The only way people are going to really understand what's going on spiritually is by immersing themselves actually in the scriptures. And I'm hoping that most people have done that, but this show is not for that. We're focused on giving you what he gave us as his plan of governance, where we would create a land of liberty and allow people to actually choose for themselves whether they're going to, you know, follow, you know, socialism or, you know, those types of things. Because we're literally in those days where we don't understand his government, and we're just deciding now politically which way we want to go. Because this nation was created to allow, and I clearly believe he wants us to make choices. That we have the freedom to make the right choice or the wrong choice. And there's way too many people out there making the wrong choice because they have failed to truly understand the government we were given. And I'll say it this way, because I was looking at going to speak with a group of people in a private section, or I should say in a private venue and so forth, where there's a lot of people there that are wired as really anti-party political stuff, because they're divided as a group between Republican, Democrat. It's, you know, kind of a social group where they, you know, it's a mortal sin to start talking politics. And this has a stranglehold on, you know, organizations, you know, whether they be business, whatever. We have locked ourselves into this. We can't talk politics. This was a wall I ran into when I started my radio show, because as I tried to appeal to businesses to support the Constitution, I'm not going to have anything to do with politics. I had a guy, a lumber, you know, store, where they sold, you know, different molding, lumber, and all sorts of stuff for builders, and more of the finishing type products and so forth. But anyway, I mean, I just asked him, you know, hey, can we have a conversation about why it's important to get behind the Constitution and, you know, and to sever ourselves from, you know, what we believe is politics. This guy just had a meltdown on me. I mean, I was kind of, it wasn't a showroom. It's, you know, out in this, you know, like a hardware store, plywood, wood everywhere. You know, just a big, huge building, no walls. And he just had a meltdown. He owned the place, and everybody was looking at him like, what the heck? It was almost like he was possessed. There was no coherence to why he was reacting the way he did, and he said what he said. And so I realized that there's, you know, there are people that are just, they've given themselves into this paradigm where anything that challenges it, they, you know, they can't handle it. They just can't handle it. But getting back to the speaking opportunity, the reality is that we were given a government and a system that confined politics to very specific things. It's one thing for us to talk about ideas like socialism, like democracy, things that are not within our government that we can kind of, communism, you know, religious things. Those things are open to discuss, but they're not open politically for choices and compromises. When it comes to our government, whether it's federal, whether it's state, or whether it's county, and technically the problem is the counties, we've enumerated the powers that we've granted them to govern. We, in our minds, believe that they have an unlimited power, that they can just compromise on any topic, anything, and as long as the majority decide to do it, then they get away with doing it. They're no longer held to the enumerations of the Constitution. If you understand this, the Constitution's limit their ability to politic. Politic being the art of compromise, to find the middle ground and to come up with the best course. Now, when you leave things as a democracy, instead of having, you know, the real unique thing about our Constitution at the federal level is it requires a supermajority to really go outside the boundaries of the Constitution, to create an amendment, to allow them to go outside those boundaries, 3/4. Not just a 50% plus one. And so the real danger that we see and why the states are literally being tossed to and fro is, one, they allow the 50% one, the mob rule, to actually flip-flop the state around. But even worse, we're at a point where nobody looks at your state constitution and determines whether your state government has the authority to do what it's doing. And when they do things that are well outside the bounds, because every state is so far outside the bounds of their own constitution. I mean, so is the federal government. But come on, folks, look at these red states. Why are these red states getting away with murder? Because everybody's paradigm is that they have general powers. They don't understand the constitutions, where the constitutions literally define their authority. That's where their authority comes from. If it's not in the Constitution, they have no authority over it. The only way we're going to get clarity, and I'm telling you, folks, anybody that's talking and predicting about what's going to happen, I mean, we do it here. We talk about, you know, what Trump should do this or what have you. We don't linger on it. And that is definitely not the point of this show. The point of this show is to show you how this government was formed and how tightly it was done. And we try to expose to you the divine hand of providence in how this government was created, so that you can see this is a divine nature. This is not something that just evolved out in, you know, in a pile of goo. It crawled up onto the shore and became this beautiful monster that we have today. No. But the only way you're going to start understanding what your government is and how you can control it is by going through these things. And the only way we're actually going to have that the desire of saving liberty and saving our government is when we, reasonable people, equally informed, finally agree that we have to work together in holding our public servants accountable. Accountable to that very those very specific powers enumerated. If they're operating outside the powers, then they are to be put back into check immediately, which is why we go through all of these different documents. And so it just, as I keep on, I think most people are realizing, don't send GR videos and references to other people. It's not that I don't like other people. It's not like that I don't get entertained by other people's ideas and their creativity. I know that the only way we're going to save our government is by we the people taking a stand and holding public servants accountable. That's the only way this is going to change. The only way it's going to get back on track to restore what he gave us. We can reclaim this republic and restore it and actually make it better than what they did. And I truly believe that if we act on faith, that we can do this. Because, folks, this may seem like a, you know, this huge monster we're going up against. But it's not. It's just a bunch of little components that are representing you there and you over here and all of us. And if we all put them all in check, that's all we really have to do, because that's how we really purge out the bad and replace those bad representatives with proper constitutional compliance ones that are going to do their job. We've got a lot of, there's a lot of little components, and it's, you know, probably a little more complicated, because we need to make sure we're finding people that have, you know, have greater honor than lust for power and lust for goods and lust for money and the avarice that lust in their hearts for, you know, making, you know, for it being about them, this love of self. Anyway, I just wanted to kind of start the show off, and boom, there goes the first segment completely. I wanted to start this first show off, or the first part of the show, with this idea that if you're one of those that receives and starts following and going, wow, that guy right there, Trump's the guy. I mean, Trump's going to do this, because this is what I keep getting. You know, the arrest by October, the arrests are going to come. There's going to be this huge political play. And that may be true. It may be true. But it doesn't mean that everybody's going to be held accountable. What it means is that some people are going to get their vengeance. Some people are, you know, going to be held accountable, you know, and it'll make feel those people who want vengeance on Obama or these other characters. You know, wow, we're getting our vengeance back on them because of the atrocities they did. But it doesn't mean we've fixed or healed our system. And so people may find, and this is, I believe, the deceit of the Antichrist, the deceits of the day, when we think that these things are good, positive things, when we have failed to do what we're supposed to be doing. Because, shoot, I'll tell you, there's going to be a lot of patriots that will fall, you know, victim to the idea that all is well because we finally got some bad people in jail. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. But that's not going to fix anything. And Trump can fix a whole bunch of things. And I think he is doing good things. And it's a lot better. It's lesser of two evils, you know. But at the same time, nothing is going to fix the problems in our country until we take back our government the way it was intended. Just like you always say, it has to come from the people.
Okay, so with that, we will be right back after this short promo. Not a sponsor, folks. We don't have sponsors. Just a short promo to talk about Republic Review, the processes, and so forth. And I probably maybe need to spend some time and update that, but we'll be back with the ratification debates.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so with that, we're in the Pennsylvania debates, and actually we even have a go back before I feel comfortable enough to move forward. And that's just because we ended the show last show on the militia. And what we want to do, or what I want to do, is I kind of want to dive back into that one assertion by Mr. McCain. So we're at the very end. Page-wise, it's 98. It is the one section at the very end where Mr. McCain has all these different topics that he kind of elucidates or, you know, dives into and clarifies. And this one happens to be speaking up to the militia. And I wanted to actually talk about the whole design, and you can kind of see this, the concern already pop up regarding the militia and being able to, you know, do services for the federal government, that they were starting to see, hey, you know, they can permanently employ these guys and take them away from us. If you wouldn't mind, let's reread the militia, if you would, please, Jean. Thank you.
It is objected that the powers of Congress are too large because, quote, they have the power of calling forth the militia on necessary occasions and may call them from one end of the continent to the other and wantonly harass them. Besides, they may coerce men to act in the militia whose consciences are against bearing arms in any case, end quote. It is true, by this system, power is given to Congress to organize, arm, and discipline the militia. But everything else is left to the state governments. They are to officer and train them. Congress have also the power of calling them forth for the purpose of executing the laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions. But can it be supposed they would call them in such case from Georgia to New Hampshire? Common sense must suppose the idea.
Interestingly enough, so when we look at the concept of the militia was for very specific purposes: executing the laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions. So when we look at the expediency of growing the Union by moving westward, what was the impetus? I believe that the impetus, by creating this lust of growing the Union quickly. Now, let me just say this. We see that Britain had already kind of learned a lesson in the Revolutionary War. Looking forward, we see how the shenanigans in playing around with us and continually harassing us basically didn't get them what they wanted. What they wanted was to humble us, and they saw us growing, and they saw us getting to a point where they either had to act or let us go, which basically laid out this stratagem that the monarch had, I don't think it was King George by this time, I think he had passed, but whoever it was in 1812, they decided, let's attack. Let's go burn down D.C. It's right there off the Potomac. We can bring our ships right up the Potomac and decimate them and kill the heart of the Union. And they did. And it was a very bold move that they were going to come in and basically seize us. And that didn't go the way they planned. And as a matter of fact, towards the very end, they ended up, you know, technically they decimated us. And going into the Treaty of Ghent, it was kind of looking like, you know, we got our butts kicked. Until the news got to them that basically said, hey, you know, this guy, Andrew Jackson, kind of cleaned their clock down there. And it looks like we, you know, got everything's now going on our way. It, you know, we've got the momentum now. Well, by that point in time, they were already working out the treaty. But when you go into the Treaty of Ghent, there's nowhere there that we've become subjected. As a matter of fact, there's lots of people who say, ah, look at that. We've become a, you know, we've been brought back under the English, you know, rule. I mean, it seems like the conspiracy theorists keep on doing this all the time. They don't read it. They've heard other people say it. They just want to believe it. Yeah, that we're under their control. We may be under their control because of other conditions and systems, but not legally and constitutionally. So the reality is that after the War of 1812, Britain basically started honoring their treaties. Britain basically had to sit there and lick their wounds and try to figure out another way to make us miserable. And it wasn't until the Civil War, so they waited a long time. And I'm telling you, folks, you can tell how possessed, you know, a person or a people are. When they're sitting there waiting and waiting for something to befall you a generation later, I believe 4 decades is easily a generation. They've waited a generation later to try to get their comeuppance. So, and still to this day, it does not bode well with the people of the British culture. I've known Brits, Australians, and others that are part of the Commonwealth that do not like celebrating the, you know, the 4th of July. And they do not, you know, they, no, you think you got away or what have you. They always try to pick a scab to the militia. The intent of the militia was not to create a standing army for the territories of the West. It was one thing if there was enough threat, then they would go basically out to stop, you know, these, we'll call them insurrections. But an insurrection, once an insurrection has been quelled, the force needs to be disbanded. What ended up happening in this expanse was they said, we're going to create a standing cavalry as we start moving westward. Said, we'll basically take the responsibility of the states away from them so they don't have to actually fend for themselves. Where half the state, what they should have done was they should have set a standard to where they had enough population where they would have a militia, an acting militia, to basically take control of the inhabitants so that either those inhabitants that didn't like the state now being a sovereign state, then then it would have been on them to move, to choose to leave somewhere else. Because either they fight and stand for whatever they wanted to fight and stand for, it would be between them and the state. It should not have been a federal responsibility to babysit. There you go, babysit, I'm putting it out there. For anybody that was a part of the cavalry or what have you, that's all you were. You were babysitting and actually creating an environment, or I should say a paradigm of entitlement, that the states were entitled to protection, when the message should have been that the states were to be self-sufficient, to be self-ruling, to be self-protecting. So this idea that the federal government would not be able to take advantage just went sideways. Because now these people, what they ended up doing was they bypassed the whole point of the militia. This is when they started legitimizing, creating an army, which basically was the cavalry. They didn't have the authority in the Constitution to have a cavalry. So I can't emphasize enough, folks, that when we really look at how our paradigm started shifting, it had more to do with the army men and those going in because of their predilection of liking one particular service over the other. The Navy was kept small, and I'll tell you how many people that became president of the United States had any Navy background. Do you know, Sean?
No, sir.
Well, John F. Kennedy.
John F. Kennedy.
There you go, John F. Kennedy. Anybody else?
That's it. That's all I got, brother.
Yeah, so, okay, so.
Maybe one of the Bushes.
Yeah, Bush was Air Force.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But Bush Sr., look him up. I think Bush Sr. was Navy, too.
That's who I was talking about.
Yeah. Bush Jr. W. was Air Force, I believe. Air Corps. I think it was pretty much Air Force, Air National Guard, whatever. But for the most part, most of them had Army because it was the big force. And it was never to be a big force. It was never to be a big force. The big force should have been the Navy. And had we bolstered the Navy in basically securing, you know, external threats, I don't know if we would have had possibly the Cold War. I think had we done things right, I think we could have easily avoided the Cold War from getting out of hand. But that being said, what it is. The whole point I really wanted to bring up is this militia being used for the Western expanse that actually converted this group of standing men. Because these men, they wanted to go around. They liked riding. They loved being out there. They loved their job. I mean, yeah, you get miserable when the weather's bad, when it's really hot and just you're singeing, you know, out in the open, or you're just, you know, in the snow, or you're in the, you know, the downpours and the hurricanes or what, tornadoes, who knows what they endured being out there. But that's what they wanted to do. Most of these men, I guess they just didn't have the desire of being married and getting tied down. You know, just going out and you know, fighting, just being ruffians, right? There you go. So they enjoyed that.
Like the cowboys.
And they made a career out of that, and they made a good living. And nobody, once you make a decision to say, you know, this is what I'm going to do for money, nobody wants to see that taken. So they love the idea of expanding and protecting their job security, what have you. I mean, job security was just as important way back then as it is today. So there were politicians and brokers that started expanding this idea on the military force. And everybody just kind of ignored the fact that what they were doing was not actually within the militia boundaries, within the way this government should have been acting. And what the government should have been doing, like I said, they should have been far more reserved. They should have been more prepared to ensure that the states, when they joined, could actually defend themselves. They had no business getting into the affairs of the Indians. If the Indians or even the French or whomever was out there, whoever was out in these territories, if they didn't like the fact that America made the claim and they're taking over, and after having a few, you know, brawls and fights with deadly force or not, then you decide, okay, you know, these people are serious. So let's either move west or let's make a last stand, right? Custer made a last stand, but that wasn't technically, it was his last stand. But that didn't mean that they didn't have somebody else to send out there and another person to send out there, because the United States was committed in securing this land. That was within their powers. They made these claims. And as I said a long, long time ago in my first book, when we look at the nature of how we conquered America, we didn't go into these, you know, these Indian tribes or what have you, as the Portuguese and the Spaniards did, and rape their women and create, you know, basically mulattoes or mixed breeds, what have you, where you now had the Mexican race come up out of the Spaniards and Indians in Mexico and Latin America, South America, and so forth. This was more of a civility and a clash of cultures, but it wasn't a brutalizing process of saying, you're going to become a part of us, whether you like it or not, we're going to rape you and molest you to do that. Because that's exactly what Britain did in its earlier history. That's what they did to the Scots. That's what they did to the British Isles. They were practicing those types of practices. Then the laws of nations said that is not what you can't be doing that. It's a violation of the laws of nations. So we became a part of that civil side out of Europe, where the Portuguese and the Spaniards just ignored it. And they, I don't know, maybe they did it and then they made it illegal, because I do realize that, you know, the laws of nations were dictating that when America was forming, because what they did and, you know, the molesting and so forth, I think that was well into the 1500s, 1600s and so forth. Because that was how, and I think that's back when England was still doing it too. I don't know if the laws of nations actually formed until the early 1600s, and that got adopted and changed and evolved. And so society evolves and the laws evolve. But this idea that a superior group of people can't, you know, move in and take over, at that point in time, was the law. As a matter of fact, the laws of nations actually had laws governing conquering. But you couldn't molest them. You couldn't, you know, you weren't supposed to do those things, which we didn't. But it's not like we did great things, but the bottom line is, had we left it to the states, it wouldn't have been a national travesty. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Because I believe each state would have actually figured out maybe a better way of working with the natives so that they could be integrated into the state and say, you know, because the state actually had, you know, the control over the land. When a state is formed and you create the state legislature, all land that hasn't been deeded to people within that state is state controlled. So that they can sell it, they can grant it, they can do whatever they want, because power's not delegated to the federal government or left to the states. And maybe when we started creating the states, they would have included Indian affairs within the state constitution, because the federal government didn't have the power to be involved in Indian affairs. Not within the states, maybe within the territory. So that's the whole point. When a state transitions into a state, everything there is the states, which is why the states should have had the ability to basically resolve these things. What the federal government did, whether they fell back asswards, forgive the expression, but whether they fell back asswards into this or not, this became an opportunity for the federal government to say, hey, we can create these reservations. Hey, we can keep some level of control and our own little autonomous zone within these sovereign states. The Constitution doesn't allow them to do that. It does not allow them to do that. The treaties that create these federal Indian reservations within a state are not constitutional. That is state property. That's a state problem. And the states need to actually do what's right to get beyond this, to say, okay, it's over. All of this domestic abuse is over. You're no longer controlled. That land that you have, that the federal government has been holding for you, it's yours now. And let the state figure out in conservatorship how to transition that land as fairly as possible. And their failings, you know, they'll be flagged for or flogged, however you want to say it. But bottom line, that's how it should have gone, period, under the Constitution. It should have been left to the states to resolve each of these problems independently. And there's no doubt in my mind these states would have come up with a better way of resolving the problem than just allowing the federal government to create this hostile little sovereign autonomous zone within your state. Anyway, so let's go to the next one, a necessary and proper, if you would, please. Thank you.
Another objection was taken from these words of the Constitution, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or office thereof, end quote. And in declaring, quote, that this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, end quote. This has at least been conceded that though it is explicit enough, yet it gives to Congress no further powers than those already enumerated. Those that first said it gave to Congress the power of superseding the state government cannot persist in it, for no person can, with a tolerable face, read the clauses over and infer that such may be the consequence. Provision is made that Congress shall have the power to prohibit the importation of slaves after the year 1808. But the gentleman in opposition accused this system of a crime because it has not been prohibited, has not prohibited it at once. I suspect those gentlemen are not well acquainted with the business of the diplomatic body, or they would know that an agreement might be made that did not perfectly accord with the will and pleasure of any one person. Instead of finding fault with what has been gained, I am happy to see a disposition in the United States to do so much. The next objections have been against the executive power. It is complained of, quote, because the hold of the executive power is not lodged in the president alone, so that there might be one responsible person. He has the sole powers of pardoning offenses against the United States and may therefore pardon traitors for treasons committed in consequence of his own ambitious or wicked projects or those of the Senate, end quote. Observe the contradiction, sir, in these two objections. One moment the system is being blamed for not leaving all executive authority to the president alone. The next is censured for giving him the sole power to pardon traitors. I am glad to hear these objections made because it forebodes an amendment in that body in which amendment is necessary. The president of the United States must nominate to all offices before the person can be chosen. He here consents and becomes liable. The Executive Council of Pennsylvania appoint officer by ballot, which effectually destroys responsibility. He may pardon offenses, and hence it is inferred that he may pardon traitors for treason committed in consequence of his own ambitious and wicked projects. The Executive Council of Pennsylvania can do the same, but the President of the United States may be impeached before the Senate and punished for his crimes. Quote, the vice president is a useless officer. Perhaps the government might be executed without him, but there is a necessity of having a person to preside in the Senate to continue a full representation of each state in that body. The Chancellor of England is a judicial officer, yet he sits in the House of Lords. The next objection is against the judicial department. The judicial power shall be vested in one Supreme Court, end quote. An objection is made that the compensation for the services of the judges shall not be diminished during their continuance in office. And this is contrasted with the compensation of the president, which is to be neither increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall be elected. But that of the judges may be increased, and the judge may hold other offices of a lucrative nature, and his judgment be thereby warped. Do gentlemen not see the reason why this difference is made? Do they not see that the president is appointed but for 4 years, whilst the judges may continue for life, if they shall so long behave themselves well? In the first case, little alteration can happen in the value of money, but in the course of a man's life, a very great one may take place from the discovery of silver and gold mines, and a great influx of those metals, in which case an increase of salary may be requisite, a security that their compensation shall not be lessened, nor they have to look up to every session for salary will certainly tend to make those officers more easy and independent. Quote, the judges may hold other offices of a lucrative nature. This part of the objection reminds me of the scheme that was fallen upon in Pennsylvania to prevent any person from taking up large tracts of land. A law was passed restricting the purchaser to a tract not exceeding 300 acres, but all the difference it made was that the land was taken up by several patents instead of one, and the wealthy could procure, if they chose it, 3,000 acres. What though the judges could hold no other office, might they not have brothers, children, and other relations whom they might wish to see placed in the offices forbidden to themselves? I see no apprehensions that may be entertained on this account.
Okay, so he actually covers a few different topics here, obviously. But to me, the one that, starts off, the necessary and proper clause, and how, you know, it is one, again, consistently laid, split asunder, this idea that there are general powers within that. And so, bottom line, it is something that he doesn't mention and highlight the foregoing powers, and he doesn't highlight the supremacy clause of, the treaties while under their authority, or which shall be made under the authority, and or laws in pursuance thereof. But to me, the important part is that he's basically laying out that there is no harm in giving them these very specific abilities to create laws necessary and proper for the foregoing powers. And again, the supremacy clause doesn't create this general power that everything that they do, regardless. I wish he would have dove into other than what he said. Congress, yet it gives to Congress no further powers than those already enumerated. So that right there is the death blow, because it ties it all from the supremacy clause to the necessary and proper clause, that they're only supreme. They can only do those things necessary and proper regarding those enumerated objects. I mean, this is kind of succinct in, how he did this. Does that make sense? I mean, to me, I look at this as a very succinct response to the perceived threat of those two clauses. What do you think?
I agree. And it is very succinct because it's very simple.
Yes. Yes. And folks, if you get anything, this is what is being said throughout the Republic in these vigorously debated conventions regarding this Constitution, that they said the exact same things. So how is it, when I started this show off, where we've come to this point where politicians can agree to actually compromise over something not enumerated and grant them the ability to create and regulate something that is not enumerated? How is it that we got here? I'm going to tell you, it all points to the courts. The courts were the ones that aggrandized all this. And as you go through this, throughout this year, we're going to be proving, plus my paper, my article. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review, as well as my description version of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.